Chronicles of a Cairo Bookseller. The streets of Cairo make strange music, the echoing calls to prayer, the raging insults hurled between drivers, the steady crescendo of horns honking, the shouts of street vendors, the television sets and radios blaring from every sidewalk. Nadia Wassef knows the song by heart. In 2002, with her sister Hind and their friend Nihal, she founded Diwan, a fiercely independent bookstore. She writes and chronicles what happened, surprisingly enough, in the book called Chronicles of Cairo, but it's much more of a business guide, as we're about to find out. Delighted to be joining me live on the line, the writer of Chronicles of Cairo Bookseller, Nadia Wassef. Nadia, good morning to you.
Good morning.
The pleasure is all mine. Whereabouts are you, by the way?
Well, at the moment, I'm sitting in North London.
Okay.
Freezing.
Yes, it's pretty much the same. It's pretty much the same actually in Spain. So I won't make you envious by saying it's a beautiful day here, but there you go. Now, for those who don't know much about Cairo and just think, okay, if you use your sort of basic schoolboy sort of Western idea, it's dusty, it's sort of from an Indiana Jones movie, it's kind of that people may know a little bit about the Cairo Spring, but that's about it. But Cairo is a teeming meeting place of nationalities and religions, and it's a fascinating place to base yourself. But before you got involved with opening the bookstore, there were no independent bookstores, is that correct?
Well, there were a lot of different types of bookstores, government ones attached to publishing houses. But this idea of the modern day bookstore that had the cafe that you would go and spend your leisure time didn't exist. And it's this idea of the third space, where it's not home, it's not work, but it's the place where you go and you become part of a community of ideas, of whatever it is that you're looking for. And I know this book takes place in Cairo, but I think that there's a more universal theme going on here, that we need to really think about bookstores, about our high streets. After the global pandemic, what's going to happen to the high street? It's not going to be there anymore because so much has gone virtual. And then when it's gone, we're going to miss it. We're going to miss the space that it was. And it's the same with bookstores.
But the thing about a bookstore is, rather than, because if you go down that, and we're about to go down a particular rabbit hole, I can sense it ourselves on this one. But if you go onto the internet, shudder, you can go down, you can say, okay, I'm looking for this book. And suddenly you find yourself, I don't know, looking for a book on one subject and then going down and finding something about the Ottoman Empire, or at least I do, or something like that, and going completely the wrong way, but in a sort of insular kind of way. But if you go into a bookstore, you meet other people and you browse and you read, and you, like you said, it's that third space. I mean, the bookstore that I used to go to a lot down here had a damn good coffee machine, and I base my life on the coffee bean, basically. So therefore, you can't do that from the comfort of your laptop.
You can't, and if you even tried, you'd be missing out on a hell of a lot. And here's the thing, I mean, at the end of the day, we need to appreciate the fact that bookstores are commercial spaces where you don't have to practice commerce. They are the place that you will go and you will bump into people who are not the same age as you, not the same gender, not the same socioeconomic class. It's everything that is not the same. And we're entering into this world thanks to social media, thanks to so many other factors. And again, another rabbit hole for you. But we're entering into this world where we're just meeting like people, and that's wrong. I don't normally like to say that stuff is wrong or right, but I don't like where we're going. And I want to fight for bookstores, and I want to say that space is one that we should cherish, because once it's gone, it's not going to come back.
And your point about the high street is absolutely spot on, because people now go to out of town centres even more so, or they don't even. And after the pandemic, you know, people didn't want to leave; they just ordered online, and they got into the habit of ordering everything online. And then they're going to go, but where have our picturesque high streets gone? Because they can't afford it, and all you're going to get is pop up shops and other sort of quick turnover. So that you're going to lose the soul.
And that's the other thing. I mean, when you think about it, where do you invest your time and your money? It's getting further and further away from where you live, from where you exist. I mean, malls are efficient and it gets the job done and it's very clean and it's very hygienic and it's lovely, but it has no soul. And I'm all for the soul. We need to go back and find it. Wherever it's gone, we need to find it and hold on to it.
I don't do clean and hygiene, as anybody who's been to my cottage will attest to. So tell me a little bit then about the name, first of all, the name of the bookstore, because there's a story behind the name as well, which I didn't know.
So Diwan, the story behind it is that actually my mother came up with the name. And it's awful when you have to say that your mum is right, but there you go. And the reasoning behind it was, I mean, my sister and I were saying all these pathetic names and she looked at us and she was like, no, you just call it Diwan. And I'm like, really? Okay, why? And she's like, well, you know, it means lots of different things in lots of different languages and contexts. So it's a collection of poetry in Persian or Arabic. It's a meeting place, a guest house, a sofa. It's a title of a high-ranking official. Diwani is a type of Arabic calligraphy. And most importantly for us, phonetically, it works in Arabic, English, French, which are the three languages of Egypt's most recent colonial history. And so these are the languages that you've got going on all the time in your, you know, day-to-day life. And you're not conscious of it. And this is one of the things that writing this book made me realize, is that there is so much that's in your DNA in terms of language, in terms of literature, in terms of culture, that you don't actually realize until you sit down and start to write it and think about it. And then you realize it's there. You didn't actually have to go looking for it. It's right there. Am I making any sense?
I'm absolutely with you this 100%. What's it like? What's it like day to day? Because again, I'm speaking to you in a studio in southern Spain. I can look across, and if I was to stand on my desk, one thing I'd probably fall off. But the other thing, I might be able to see Morocco because it's only 14 kilometers across the straits. So there is that little bit of sort of chaos theory and crisis management that makes up the Maghreb. What's it like doing business in Cairo?
Well, look, I mean, this is everybody's favorite question. The minute they see woman and Egyptian, they immediately ask me. So thank you for conforming.
I have my moments, you know.
So the thing is, in all honesty, it is no different than doing business anywhere else in the world. I mean, I think people would like to, they assume that your gender plays a big, big part. I mean, I think for me, what was more of a stumbling block is ageism rather than gender. At the time when we started this bookstore, I was, I think, 27 years old. So, you know, you'd walk into a publisher's office, they'd never heard of you, you have no business experience in this specific domain, and you're telling them, you know, I'd like to open an account with you and I want to stock your books. And they're looking at you and you're like, but you're too young to know anything about anything, let alone this business. And so I think for me, the bigger challenge was age, definitely not gender. And in my experience, when you don't make it your problem, it's not your problem. I mean, feel free to make it someone else's problem. But I mean, for me, being a woman never got in the way. And I don't ascribe to that school of thought. And I don't give, power structures the pleasure of being their victim. I don't work that way.
As well as being it could have been a day to day. Well, we did this and we went to try and get this publisher to stock his books. But you also use the book as an exploration of what it means to be Egyptian and how, you know, Egypt is, you touched on that colonial thing of it, Egyptian, British, and also French. And you were at the British school in Cairo, I believe. Was that correct?
Oh, yes.
Right.
Yes. And I celebrated Guy Fawkes Day. And we had, you know, what was it called? Shrove Tuesday?
Pancake Day. Yeah.
Yeah, the lemon and sugar pancake business and all of that. And we had our weekends on Saturday and Sunday, whereas Egypt's weekends are Friday and Saturday. So, you know, we were the British International School in Cairo, but we existed outside of Cairo, actually. And all of these things, you know, it's one thing to sit there and talk about colonialism and neocolonialism, But it's actually, the reality is, all of this stuff is in your DNA, and you own, I mean, you know, the British came to Egypt, they went to India. And by the way, my theory on that is because of the weather.
Right.
I think the weather is so bad that they had to go somewhere else to get away from the weather. I mean, I think, you know, other than the fact that colonialism was an extremely profitable capitalistic venture, I also think it was really just an escape from the weather. I mean, that's just my take on it, having lived in the UK for a while now.
Can I even ask you about the items that are in the British Museum at the moment that should be going back to Egypt?
Well, I mean, we're not going to go there, but if anybody wants to go to the end of chapter two, they can find what I, they can really see how I feel about that. But, you know, one of the things I have tried to do in Chronicles of a Cairo Bookseller is to show how, in many ways, we've all assimilated languages, cultures that are not our own, but we've made them our own. And the same thing with place. Yes, this book does take place in Cairo, but I read somewhere that James Joyce had once said when he wrote, I think he was writing Ulysses, and he said, I try to find the heart of every city. No, I try to find the heart of Dublin, because if I can understand the heart of Dublin, I can understand the heart of every city. And within the particular lies the universal. And I think this is one of the things, you know, how people feel about their cities, their spaces, how much these spaces make us. And we don't realize it, I guess, until we're not there, until we're sitting somewhere else, and then we start to realize all of these things. I mean, you're sitting in Spain, and I bet you're configuring your world quite differently.
Yeah, well, no? Yes, absolutely. I was about to say, you know, we all take things from different, your previous point, we all take things from different cultures. But we mean this in a good way, because one of the things that was levelled at, because Spain is a particular case in point. We're in southern Spain, we're in Andalusia, Al-Andalus, run by the Moors for 700 years, exactly. You know, Mike, there is still the terraced agriculture and the waterways that the Moors and the Romans put in on the land I live on. However, we take from various cultures in a good way, to be more, if you like nomadic magpies, rather than just becoming this sort of central European sort of Benelux. And nothing personal against the Dutch or the Belgians, please. But we all eat the same food, we all dress the same way, we go to the same universities, we watch the same TV series. But what you're saying is we should all take from different cultures and make them our own.
Yes, and we do. We absolutely do. And I mean, you know, in when I talk about the presence of the British and the history and the language and I'm talking about how we take these things and we absorb them and we make them our own. One of the things that is in the book that the book was released in America in October, and the Americans in a couple of reviews were saying things like, well, there are plenty of F-bombs that the writer uses. First of all, I didn't know that it was called an F-bomb.
Right.
So that was a new contribution to me.
To the cultural identity. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and they were saying, you know, well, the use of F-bombs is troubling. And I thought, well, this is interesting because, you know, the day before yesterday, Guantanamo Bay celebrates its 20th anniversary. And I think that's far more offensive than a couple of F-bombs. But there you go. That's who I am. But going back to this, so in one of the chapters, I talk about the Arabian Nights, the 1001 Nights, Alf Leila U Leila, and that one of the problems that people had with this text is that it mixed the sacred and the profane, that there were all these wonderfully highbrow, you know, how should human beings behave to reach a higher level of being, blah, blah, blah. And then there were all these earthly, very sort of base kind of behavior going on. And it was two types of language on the same page together. And I realized that that was one of the things I had done, that I would express myself perhaps in a very openly, you know, expressive way, and at the same time, use very sort of, you know, poetic language to talk about things that mattered to me. And I think having these two things on the page were also irking people. And it was interesting to me that I was getting the same reaction that the Arabian Nights got, you know, 200 years later.
It's interesting because I just looked across at the Washington Independent Review of Books, and they go on about the fact that Naked Chef, you know, wasn't allowed. It was deemed not to be the review said it was deemed not to be suitable for Egypt. But they said, and I quote, this educated, this is you, by the way, this educated, successful, outspoken woman who regularly drops the F-bomb in casual conversation, even with her young daughters.
Well, that's not technically. Well, the thing is, I found it fascinating that that's what the reviewer chose to zoom in on. But again, I kept thinking about the Arabian Nights, and there's a full chapter where this is discussed. But going back to the Naked Chef, there is this incident in the book, and you know, what I find fascinating is there is so much in this book about how we lose so much meaning in our own sort of, when things get lost in cultural translation. Mm. And there's so much that goes on around us that we don't realize because perhaps we just don't know our countries. For instance, I remember that after the Egyptian Revolution, there were all these referendums. And I would go to bed every night thinking, I know the outcome of this vote. It's a clear yes. And I'd wake up the next morning and the results would be no. Does this sound familiar at all?
Vaguely, yes, indeed, yes.
This was so fascinating that, you know, people are people everywhere. And when you live in the city center, you think one way or in big centers, but the rest of the country thinks in a very different way. And this is also one of these universal truths. How much of our countries, of our societies, do we actually know? How different is experience based on the space that you occupy, based on your socioeconomic position, based on your understanding of language? How much of it is different? And to me, this was fascinating. And it was fascinating being an Egyptian in London watching Brexit unfold. Mm. So, and it was fascinating to me being an Egyptian in Egypt watching, you know, the post-revolution unfold. Because again, how, you know, what is our experience? What is it dictated by? How do we process what it is around us? How is it that I'm sitting here and I have one understanding of the world and somebody three blocks down has a completely different understanding? I find this today fascinating.
Well, that's from their own personal experiences, their social stroke economic backgrounds as well, and what they view and they experience and they read. And as the owner of a bookstore in Cairo, surely this was something, because if you can't afford to leap on a private jet, and few of us can, and go to those places, then the best way to find first-hand experience is to read it. And I don't care how many TikTok videos you see or how many YouTube videos you see, nothing beats the personal word of experience. And books have brought me to tears more times than watching some YouTuber has.
Absolutely. And I mean, really, one of the things that I will always say about being in a bookstore is that I have learned more from customers. And I mean, somebody once asked me, you know, who was your most annoying customer? And I think there is, you know, yeah, I mean, I've had a few, I got to say, but there are no bad customers because they're all good customers because they will teach you something. So, you know, we had the guy that would come in all the time and argue that, you know, he didn't like the ending and he wanted to return the book. And this was constant. And he was one of my favorites because it was just great. You know, you'd have everything going on around you, and then he'd come in and you'd be having, it was Groundhog Day, you know, you'd be having the same thing over and over again. And there was something very soothing about it. And there was the other customer who wanted to see ancient Egypt everywhere. And I kept thinking about it and I realized, well, you know, we all love ancient Egypt, fantastic. But what's really going on here? And I mean, for him, I think he could only deal with being part of a country that was great, being part of a civilization that ruled the world. For him, it was this either grandeur or nothing.
Can I go back to your Brexit remark a bit earlier than about 5 minutes ago?
You go ahead. The mic is all yours.
No, please. But no, the thing with the bookstore is that in a world of 24/7 constant pulsating, screaming, look at me, attention grabbing, I'm surrounded by five screens here as I speak. The pace of books and the sanctuary of somewhere to actually take the time and read and think and form an observed opinion is surely more precious than anything.
Absolutely. And by the way, I don't know about you, but I'm going to just totally confess that I have a very limited attention span. I struggle. Okay, for viewers here, for listeners, he is raising his hand and saying yes.
They know me by now. Trust me, they know me. Yes, but yes.
So I struggle, and I feel like this is something I have to do. Most of the time, you know, we struggle with something, we give in. This one, I'm not giving in. I'm fighting to hold on to my attention span as much as age and two teenage daughters and life is whittling away at it. I'm still holding on, and I'm still reading my books, and I still post about them because I feel like that is something I have to keep on doing for my own humanity, if nothing else.
Diwan, did you get an offer that people wanted to franchise it? Surely that would have been, wouldn't that have been anathema to what you were trying to do with the store itself?
Well, I mean, you're talking to a control freak. So, okay. Well, I mean, no, actually, I'm a rehabilitated control freak. So I don't do these things anymore. I let things unfold and I don't meddle and I accept. Okay. But this has taken 20 years of upward hill stuff. But no, I mean, I think at the time when you don't know any better, you think, and this is part of my beef with capitalism, that you start with one store and it does well. And so you think, I don't just want two or three or four. I want more. I just want more. And there is something so wrong with that. And one of my regrets, but I mean, I'm saying that it's a regret, but if you gave me the chance to do it all over again, I would do exactly the same thing. So it's a sort of, what shall we call it? A sort of subliminal or a low-grade regret, shall we call it? Is that I rushed. You know, it would have been so much more soulful to just let, you know, I mean, from first store to second store, there were 5 years in between. And then, you know, from 2 to 10, it all happened in the space of 5 years. So that's ridiculous. And I would have slowed down a lot more. I would have gone for a much more organic growth rather than a growth on steroids. And one of the things, I mean, my relationship and one of the things that I notice in this book is, you know, how relationships change and they metamorphose, and we have to give them the time to do that. So I began falling madly in love with Diwan. And I was very possessive of it. And I wasn't going to, so this was my baby. It was my first love. It was my firstborn. It was everything. And then when things went sour, things really went sour. And it was very difficult for me. I realized that I was heartbroken over the fact that this expansion didn't go well. And it didn't go as I wanted it to go. And by the end of the book, I start to realize, well, actually, I think Diwan is a person and she has a personality and she's rebelling against me and it's not okay. And there is this struggle that goes on between me and Diwan. Yes, and I'm not nuts. It is a bookstore. I know that.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
It's fine. Sorry, you know, I wrestle with the radio shows every day. Don't worry about that.
Okay, so I'm just going to keep on going and you're fine with this. So, and then I got a thumbs up, guys. And then after a while, when I sort of realized that it was hopeless to keep on struggling with a business that didn't want to be expanded in the way that I wanted to expand it, and that this wasn't going well, and we had to shrink after we'd expanded, we had to close down a lot of stores and deal with the fact that, you know, we were firmly in the red and the black was far, far away from us, and tough decisions had to be made. Once I accepted that, and then after a while, you know, we tried to get a CEO to run it. That didn't work. We did a 5-person team. That didn't work. Everybody stepped away. And then it was almost like Diwan invited in what Diwan wanted, which was our partner, Nihal, and two ex-Diwan employees came back in and said, we're going to run it and we're going to do it our way. And at that point, and my sister and I had stepped back, and it's lovely that now I have this new relationship with Diwan. I'm no longer possessive. I'm no longer angry. We've made up. I accept the fact that, you know, it's not that Diwan won, but Diwan got what Diwan wanted and I got what I wanted. And at the end of the day, I think I went wrong when I became a businesswoman and I decided to prioritize income over impact. What is important? And again, I'm going to go back to this and say that this global pandemic, because I know, you know, we all have, you know, what are the goldfish memories? That's the one, the short memory.
Yeah, that's the one, yeah.
Yeah, so we all have that. And definitely, you know, I'm a 47-year-old woman with a very bad attention span. So I'm going to just say that if there's one thing that we need to really think about is some kind of compassionate capitalism. It can't just be all about more because, I mean, there's not going to be anything left. We can't just all be driven by this all the time. And I don't have any answers, just in case that was your next question. But I'm just saying...
I was hoping that's going to be the next book, to be honest with you. That was going to be or at least, I mean, there could be a vacancy at Prime Minister as well, if you hang around North London long enough. So you never know, Nadia. I mean, that could be the next move.
Right, but I don't have a garden to throw garden parties.
This so is awesome. It's
very problematic. Well, but the job does offer a garden. I forgot.
And a library too, I should imagine. I'm going to run out of time. I'm going to commit the cardinal sin of what we call is of crashing the news. If people want to find more information and read the book, and I please go and read the book. It will be available as a download from our virtual bookstore as well. But where can people find you online, Nadia? Where is there a website? Where can they do? Tell me you have a Twitter account. Tell me you do Instagram. Tell me you do something like that.
No. Twitter, it's too hostile for me. I'm a voyeur on Twitter. Nobody follows me, and I just, you know, voyeur.
You watch from the sidelines, do you?
I do, where it's nice and safe. No, on Instagram, it's Nadia the Bibliophile, and I just post about stuff that I love.
Nadia the Bibliophile, absolutely wonderful. This book is called Chronicles of a Cairo Bookseller. It's by Nadia Wassef, who we've been speaking to. Nadia, it's been we went down our own peculiar rabbit hole there. One of the things about I love about my job is you can ask somebody a question, you can think where you're going to go, and then you can end up somewhere completely different. Nadia Wassef, thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It was lovely. I love talking to you.